Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
All right, so why don't we start here? And I appreciate you saying it. How is Royal Portrush as a course, Rex, playing right now? How would you describe that course to somebody who has never played it?
Well, I think if you watch it on TV, you get the idea of how different it is than the normal links courses. We go to St. Andrews, we go to Royal Liverpool, pick wherever you want, and it almost looks like a moonscape probably when you're watching it on TV. It doesn't even look like something you would play golf on, but this is different. It's green and lush, and there's tons and tons of elevation changes, and I think that's the difference. And getting so much feedback from players, when you come to a new course like this, you usually get a 50-50 split. Some guys will like it, some guys won't like it. I haven't talked to one player this week that doesn't just absolutely love this golf course, and I think everybody coming in knew this was going to be a special Open.
Well, Rex, it's new to most guys, but certainly not Rory McIlroy. He came in this week with so much buzz because he was playing at home on a course where he shot the course record 61, and he did it as a 16-year-old. Then he had that tee shot on the first hole that hit a woman and broke her phone. What did you make of the way he started his day?
It was shocking. I mean, let's face it, he was the favorite coming in here for all the right reasons. He's played great this season. He's won twice. He, as you pointed out, he's played this course probably more than anyone else that's in the field this week. I just think there should have been a comfort level. But I noted it earlier in the week when I wrote a column about him that it was always going to be difficult because of the expectations and the pressures of this event coming back to Northern Ireland for the first time since 1951. And the significance probably is going to be lost on most American fans. It was lost on me, really, until just the last few months. But this is a huge move for Northern Ireland, a huge move for the RNA. And it meant the world to Rory, and I think you saw a little bit of that on the first tee when he pulls it out of bounds and just makes a mess of the hole and just has an awful day.
Hey, Rex, I'm not looking to pile on. Well, maybe not too much, but have you ever seen a contender, let alone a favorite, open a major with a shot that terrible?
I don't know that Ian Baker Finch would have been considered a favorite by any stretch. He probably would have been considered a contender when he was at St. Andrews a few years after winning the Open, and you've been to St. Andrews, so you know how hard it is to snap hook a ball off the first tee out of bounds. He did that. So that's the only thing I could possibly think of that's even close.
We're talking to Rex Hoggard. All right, so Phil Mickelson also had a lot of attention, Rex, coming in large part because he directed it his way with that Instagram video about him going on a six-day fast. Let me start there. What was your reaction when you heard that he had gone on a fast and lost 15 pounds?
I mean, it's Phil. We're used to this nonsense from Phil, right? I mean, he's always going to be looking for something different and something new and different diets, different golf clubs. This is a guy that played at U.S. Open at Torrey Pines with no drivers and a Masters with two drivers in his bag. I mean, this is quintessential Phil. How he played, though, didn't necessarily surprise me. He said earlier in the week, he made it clear, he doesn't feel like his game's in a very good position, and he kind of described what he's going through right now as sort of a lifestyle choice about getting on a better diet, trying to be a little bit more healthy. And honestly, at 48, he doesn't have a whole lot to prove in his career, so it is encouraging. I mean, if he can remain healthy and strong, I think he can be a contender on tour at least for the next two or three years.
So, Rex, I mean, what's the biggest problem with this game right now? For instance, Father Time comes for everybody. So when you look at him, is that what that's about? Is time catching up to him physically, or is some of this in his head? What is the biggest issue with this game?
I think some of it's in his head because this isn't new. He's talked about this for the last two or three years about being in the middle of the round and losing focus and not being able to concentrate, which always struck me as being odd. Even in the biggest events, at the U.S. Open or the Masters, whatever the case may be, he always sort of had these lapses, and he couldn't really explain them. And so I think part of this is he is really at the point of his career. He's won this before. The only event that really mattered to him, I truly believe, was the U.S. Open. And after finishing the way he did at Pebble Beach just a few weeks ago, you have to think that's probably his last chance to win that event and complete the career Grand Slam. And I just think there was always going to be a mental letdown that, you know, his window is probably closed on that tournament. It's going to be hard to motivate yourself after that.
Rex Hoggard is joining us. We're breaking down the first round of the Open Championship. Meanwhile, Rex, Shane Lowry, who was playing alongside Phil, shot a 4-under-67. He took the early lead. What did you make of that performance from him?
He didn't have nearly as much pressure as Rory did, but being from Ireland, I think there was some pressure there. He talked about being very uneasy this week coming into it. And he had to sit with his swing coach and his team last night. And they really had to build him up and give him some confidence. And he understood that, look, this means the world to me. I'm playing well. I'm from Ireland. It's in Portrush. I really feel like I should do something. And they had to talk him down and tell him that it's not the end of the world. And I think that it really broke through, that, you know, it struck a chord, and he was able to go out today and play a very, very solid round.
Rex Hager joining us. Now, Rex, local knowledge is getting a lot of run as a talking point this week. Brooks Koepka's got the advantage of having a caddy in Ricky Elliott, who grew up there and has played this course more times than he can count. How valuable is it to have that local knowledge?
I think it's huge. I mean, Ricky on the bag was always going to be a big deal for Brooks simply because Ricky just didn't grow up here and play it. I mean, he was one of the top amateurs in the area. If you talked to Graham McDowell earlier this week, he talked about being motivated by Ricky because Ricky was so good when those two were growing up around here, and he was sort of the guy always to beat. So he's a guy that gets on this golf course, and let's face it, he's a great caddy. Those two are yin and yang. Ricky is outgoing and funny and smiling and always cracking jokes, and we all know that Brooks kind of has that stoic demeanor. The blinders are always on. They're always the perfect pair, but this week I think you're really going to see it, and he's tied for the lead. I mean, I'm not surprised by that.
No, he's tied for the lead. He's playing really well right now. How do you like the way the course fits his game?
I think any course fits his game well. I mean, you could sit here and go through. I mean, we talked about sort of how Lynx Golf brings more guys into the mix. So, you know, now all of a sudden you can kind of look at a Jim Furyk or a Zach Johnson or even a Lou Oosthuizen and say, yeah, you know, they don't hit it far enough on a normal tour golf course, but here they can control their golf ball and they're smart enough. That there's something to that, but I just think when you're Brooks Koepka and you can hit the driver and hit it as straight as he does relative to his distance, I just think any golf course is going to set up well for him.
We're talking to Rex Hager for another moment or so. So Rex, Koepka had this great quote earlier this week when he said, quote, "I just practice before the majors. Regular tournaments, I don't practice. If you've seen me on TV at a regular PGA Tour event, that's when I play golf." I mean, that's an amazing quote, really. So when people try to figure out why Koepka is so much better in the majors than regular tournaments, is it as simple as he practices before the majors and doesn't before the regular tour events? Is that all that is?
There might be something to it. I mean, let's face it. He has found whatever the secret sauce is in these events, at least over the last 2 years. And maybe that is not getting wore out week in and week out, trying to peak every single week you put a tee in the ground. And he's got into a very good routine of making sure those four times a year he's playing his best. In his last four major starts, he's finished first, second, first, second. I see where this is heading. I can look at trends.
All right, so when you look at the weather, if you can see where this is heading, when you look at the weather and the way the course is playing right now, what kind of a winning score are you expecting to see on Sunday?
I actually would have been really surprised if they got it to double digits. I simply think this golf course is so unique, and I think guys are trying to learn it on the fly and with the conditions. But the way it's trending right now, I would think anywhere around 11, 12 under par is a really good number.
Who else do you like come Sunday besides Koepka?
Well, I kind of just looked down the leaderboard. Sergio Garcia, he's played in these enough times. I mean, if his putting holds up, I think he would be a guy to watch. But the one that stands out to me is Tommy Fleetwood. I think someone referred to him today as golfing Jesus. He's the perfect fit for this golf course. He doesn't hit it crazy long, but he's plenty straight enough, and grew up in England. He knows how to play links golf courses. I think he could make a move.
I like him, too. I like him a lot. I like John Rahm. I like Patrick Cantlay. And I like Brooks Koepka. Rex Hager is Rex number 7. Remember, you can follow him on Twitter at RexHagerGC, golfchannel.com, senior writer. He is on site at Royal Portrush. Rex, great to have you back. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jim, man.
Have a great day. Rex, who do you like? Did you get any action on the tournament? Are you an Elks game? I'll reset that for you. Tiger might be having a worse day than Rory. Rory had a horrible day. Change up. Talk some NFL right now. We are joined by a senior NFL reporter for Yahoo, co-host of the Yahoo Sports NFL podcast. I'm speaking of Charles Robinson. My man, Charles, what's going on? How are you?
Doing well, Jim. We're back in it.
We are back in it. In fact, I was going to start right there. Camps are opening up. Players are showing up. What is this time of year like for you?
Busy. I'm going to be on the road. I'm actually in L.A. We're doing some studio shoots with some players right now who are all kind of fitting in their last-minute advertising obligations, and then hit the road for Cardinals camp on the 25th. But, yeah, I'll be on the road for a month solid, so it's always exciting. Everybody's, you know, the positive storylines, the holdouts. You know, everybody wants to see how the young quarterbacks look. So I'm ready to go. It's been a long off season.
You are in it. Let's break some of that down. Why don't we start with the Browns, where there is so much buzz right now? You made the point that when you watched Baker Mayfield last year, the entire Browns team looked at him and said, "That's our guy. That's our leader." You've been around that league a long time. How many times have you seen a team do that with a rookie quarterback?
It's rare. It was mind-boggling because it's, you know, I think people don't understand when these guys, whether you're the first pick or, you know, if you're a first-round quarterback, none of that really matters because you can be a 22, 23-year-old guy, 21-year-old guy. If you're walking in and you're the starter, you have grown men with families, with obligations, with all these things, guys who know the league. They know the cutthroat mentality, and now all of a sudden – you have to lead them. You have to stand in that locker room and be the guy. And more often than not, rookie quarterbacks who get thrust into that situation, like a Lamar Jackson, you know, they dial it back a little bit. Josh Allen was a guy who I think with the Buffalo Bills, he was dialed back a little bit. He was sort of like, hey, I'm going to go out there, do my thing, lead by example. Baker was like, I'm going to go out there and do my thing, but I'm going to talk too. And I'm going to push guys to be better. And I'm going to say, this is what we need to be. And when you know, Jackson obviously was fired and joined the Bengals. Baker was like one of the first guys to step up in that Browns locker room and go, yo, that's not right. Like, this guy just flipped on us. He just went to the, you know, the other team in our state. This guy is now our enemy. To me, it was just wild to see a guy. And, you know, I kind of made the comparison to Draymond Green. You see some of these guys in pro sports where coaches get their hands on a guy who comes in the locker room and suddenly places more expectations on the players than even a coach has to, may even coach players harder than a coach does. And, yeah, I mean, he was just one of those guys where it was miraculous the way that they immediately all gravitated toward him. And, you know, now you hear stars on other teams who look at Baker Mayfield and would like to play with him. And I think Odell, that was one of the big reasons why he didn't throw a bigger fit about the trade to Cleveland. Not only is he going to play with Jarvis Landry, but he has a relationship with Baker, and he believes in Baker, and Odell might be, honestly, the most talented player in pro football right now.
Charles Robinson joining us. Man, that is such a great response. There is so much to unpack in that, and Baker's got Odell's back. I can't get enough of the guy. I mean, I absolutely love Baker Mayfield. I cannot get enough of him. I think they are America's team. I think he is America's quarterback. And the point that you made that Baker – not only is he all in and not afraid and is going to speak his mind, he gets pissed off when guys don't do their job. So from a coach's standpoint, how much does that fire up a coach when he sees a quarterback, much less a young quarterback, is coaching his guys as hard or even harder than the head coach himself?
Oh, I think I think Freddie Kitchens is psyched. I mean, and I think that's part of why Freddie Kitchens has that job, is just because he and Baker, when Freddie Kitchens was the quarterback's coach and Todd Haley was the OC, Baker really formed his strongest bond with Freddie Kitchens first. And I think what Baker really gravitated toward with Freddie Kitchens, and a big reason why Freddie Kitchens ended up getting that job, the team knows that Baker is the centerpiece. They know that he is, even with Myles Garrett on the roster, even with Odell Beckham, this is their leader. This is their emotional compass. He's got the map. And I think Baker always felt like Freddie Kitchens let Baker be himself. Whereas, interestingly enough, that what I always heard was Todd Haley was hard on Baker, did not want Baker speaking out, didn't want Baker trying to take a more authoritative, like, leadership role. And Freddie Kitchens was just like, look, man, be yourself. Be, you know, talk. Say what you got to say. Push guys. And, you know, clearly I think that brought out a lot of, you know, the best parts of Baker. And to me, what's remarkable about him is sometimes guys come out and they do this and you think it's an act. You're like, okay, they know they should be like this, so they sell it. He's legit. Like, he is legitimately upset, pushing guys. If he feels like you're not on board with him and the Browns, it's like with the Duke Johnson negotiations. He might have spoke out, and the coaching staff, guys like Freddie Kitchens, might have been like, yeah, don't talk about other guys' deals. But behind the scenes, they're like, but he's right. He said the right thing. Get on board with us.
Hey, listen, I can't get enough. I could do this for an hour alone, but let me hit you up with another topic or two. Charles Robinson joining us. The way Antonio Brown left Pittsburgh, it would be very easy for people to say, good, man, good, beat it, good riddance. They'll be better off without him. But when you take a step back and you take the emotion out of it, how big of a loss is that for the Pittsburgh offense?
Yeah, that's the funny thing. Everyone's like, well, addition by subtraction. I'm like, I don't know, man. This might be subtraction by subtraction. Like, for all, I get it. I understand he was a pain to deal with. I've been in their camp for years. I mean, he was a guy that I can always remember in the preseason. You know, he would play a lot to the crowds in the preseason. You'd see guys on defense kind of rolling their eyes about, you know, he'd score a touchdown and kind of put it in the defense's face. And, like, there were clearly guys in that locker room that felt like he had those diva qualities and it rubbed them the wrong way. But you know what? They put up with it for years because the guy was an automatic to go out and catch 100, 120 balls. he might have been greedy about his catches, but he produced. And when you have an automatic cog in that offense who really is such a perfectionist about what he does when he gets on the field and you remove him, I'm sorry, there's going to be a void. And the Steelers and the fans, they're kidding themselves that they just think, well, getting the attitude out is all that really mattered. No, now you have to replace really what's going to be 120 catches and a technician on that team who younger guys did look at. Look, Juju Smith-Schuster, I mean, as I know they had their falling out, but the truth is Juju looked at Antonio and learned a lot of things before Antonio went out the door about being a pro. So that's another thing that you take off the roster. I get losing the drama, and that's understandable, but you hit it on the head, man. There's a void when you lose an elite-level receiver, and that's what he is. It changes some of the dynamic of that offense. That's what makes this camp so important.
And let's give Mr. Big Chest credit, too, for working. Man, this guy works. He's got an unbelievable work ethic. So he's gone. Le'Veon Bell is gone. But, Charles, when you talk to people around the league, how big of a loss is the loss of offensive line coach Mike Munchak?
Massive. Like, I think what was interesting to me was Munchak, I think the last two seasons when you talk to guys about who's the best assistant in the NFL who's not a coordinator, and you talk about, you know, guys who could potentially make the leap to a head coaching job from an assistant coach role, Munchak was the name that came up. They're like, look, he's got the head coach mentality. He's an unbelievable, in terms of the film room organization, a technique teacher, a leader. Like, he was just that guy as an offensive line coach for the Pittsburgh Steelers, which is why he became a head coaching commodity from a skill position, assistant position, rather than a coordinator position. So for him to end up off that roster is a significant loss. I think personally, it's vastly overshadowed. We talk about Le'Veon, we talk about Antonio Brown not being there, but to me, Mike Munchak is the one guy who made that line go. Now, granted, They're a veteran group. They return all those guys. So thankfully you still have that presence, guys who already learned how to do it with Mike Munchak. But you can't afford to lose extra head coaches off your staff. And really the Pittsburgh Steelers definitely lost one.
Charles Robinson doing his thing, breaking it all down. All right, so what about Kansas City? They're coming off that huge year last year. They do not have Kareem Hunt. There's the ongoing situation with Tyreek Hill. How do you think Kansas City shows up this season?
Well, first off, you got to figure out running back. I mean, look, is it going to be Damien Williams? Like, you have to look at the depth there and figure out, is there going to be a guy who's going to rise up into that, you know, 1,000-yard rusher, 500-yard receiver? Like, running back, I think when you really broke it down after you lose Kareem Hunt, their offense did change. It struggled a little bit. It was a little less dynamic. So I think sorting out running backs is a big deal for them. But look, everybody just wants to know what's going on with Tyreek Hill. The longer tape comes out, we had the short tape, sounded really bad for Tyreek Hill. We get the full 11, 12-minute tape in the context. It still sounds bad, but, man, there was a lot there that was not initially reported when the first tape comes out. I think the Chiefs right now feel very cautiously optimistic that they're going to have Tyreek Hill for most of the season, if not all of the season, when this is all shaken out from the NFL standpoint. They're careful about saying that publicly because, look, they watched the Dallas Cowboys say it about Zeke, and then he got popped for six games. And so, you know, look, you just never really know when it's in the hands of Roger Goodell. But I think they know, look, the number one priority on this offense is going to know, are we going to have Tyreek Hill on the field 100%? And then beyond that, sorting out really what's going on with the running back situation. They feel great about Frank Clark, Tyrann Mathieu. They feel like that defense has got some edginess to them. To me, if that team doesn't make the Super Bowl out of the AFC, particularly if Tyreek Hill is there all season, something went wrong. That should be a Super Bowl team in Kansas City.
Charles Robinson joining us. We're talking NFL. You mentioned Zeke Elliott. Now, you know, there's been various reports about that situation with his contract. Remember, the Cowboys did play hardball with DeMarco Murray after he put up huge numbers and then left for Philadelphia. I'm not saying they're one and the same, but could you see them doing the same thing with Elliott, or does a deal eventually get done?
I mean, that's what Elliott's worried about, you know. I think he's looking at – he knows that this is a season where top to bottom, the Cowboys have one of the best rosters in the NFL. Like, I think it's a Super Bowl-worthy roster. They might have the best two deep in the NFL or pretty darn close to it in terms of their depth. And Zeke knows I'm the anchor on offense. there are guys in personnel who will tell you privately, like, look, we love Dak, he's great, but we all know this is an offense that right now orbits. We'll see if it continues this way under Kellen Moore, but it orbits around Zeke. And, you know, so Zeke's sitting there going, look, I'm going to be a 25, you know, to 30 touch a game guy potentially this season. That's just how it's going to be. And I want that long-term security. Plus, I look at, as you said, DeMarco Murray, they wore him out and then just said, look, here's what DeMarco considered a low-ball offer. I think in Zeke Elliott's mind and in his camp's mind, there was a six-year plan for him with the Dallas Cowboys and then wave goodbye. We'll get you through the 5 years of your rookie deal. We'll franchise tag you once and pay you one time for one season. But by then, you'll have so many carries on you, we'll be good letting you go elsewhere like we did with DeMarco Murray. That's part of what's going on right now and him trying to figure out, is it time to put my foot in the sand and try to hold out right now to get that long-term security?
It's good info. Charles, one more topic I've got to ask you about. Golden Tate recently said that Matthew Stafford was the best quarterback he ever played with. Legend has it that there was a dinner a while back where an NFL head coach said, quote, Aaron Rodgers is great, sure, but Matthew Stafford is the bleeping natural, end quote. You were at that dinner. I know better than to ask you who the coach was, but what was your reaction to that comment?
I mean, like I said, I think I tweeted about this. I definitely counted the number of wine bottles on the table at that point.
Right.
I was shocked, honestly, to hear this coach say it. And I know that, you know, we talked about it a little bit. It was a very prominent coach. It was someone who knows quarterbacks, who's touched guys who are absolutely Hall of Fame caliber guys. I was stunned to hear him say that. Yeah, I don't know. Look, Matthew Stafford, tough as nails, great quarterback. I just don't know. I don't know that anyone else at the table agreed, and I'm trying to think off the top of my head. There were four other head coaches, a general manager, an assistant general manager were at that table. I don't know that anybody really agreed, and there was definitely some scoffing from across the table about, like, hey, back it off, let's cut it off. They're waving the waitress away, no more bottles of wine.
I cut him off. Charles Robinson is a senior NFL reporter for Yahoo. He is the co-host of the Yahoo Sports NFL podcast in Los Angeles right now, about to hit the road for an entire month. My man, great job, Charles. Always good to have you on this show. Appreciate the input so much.
Anytime, Rome. Always my pleasure.
Good job, bud. Really well done. He is one of the best to do it. Charles Robinson. We are joined right now, as promised, by somebody who played 9 years in the NFL, 420 tackles, 44 and a half sacks, 214 quarterback pressures. He was an All-American and an ACC Defensive Player of the Year at Georgia Tech. He was the 16th pick overall in 2010. He announced his retirement on Monday. I am going to jump into it right now with Derek Morgan. Derek, great to have you back. How are you?
What's up, Jim? Thanks for having me on.
So good to have you. So, Derek, one of the toughest things for any athlete is to know when it's time. How did you know it was time for you to move on and pursue something else?
I've always said that I was going to play as long as it made sense. And, you know, from a physical standpoint, mentally, and multi different facets that I had to analyze going into the season. And, you know, I've had 9 surgeries over my career. So it was getting to a point where, you know, I take my, you know, my approach to the game very seriously. So, you know, every ounce of the day I was preparing, you know, getting work done on my body to maintain my body at a certain level. And, you know, the longer you're in the league, the more you have to do. And so the balance of things in my life was kind of getting out of whack. I got 2 kids. I'm married. And so, you know, I that was one of the things I always achieved or tried to achieve, is that balance in my life. And, you know, the stuff off the field that I've been involved with has been very, you know, purposeful for me. I've been kind of finding myself drawn to that type of stuff more. And it's been very stimulating to me. And so, you know, I had a strong inclination that going into this year would be my last, depending on, you know, a couple different factors. But, you know, I made the decision, and I feel very at peace with it.
All right, so you go out on your own terms. That's something else that a lot of athletes don't get to do. Derek, that response to me was really thoughtful. I want to read something that you posted on Instagram. You said, quote, over the years, it's brought a lot of struggle, triumph, adversity, and joy to my life. It helped shape me into the man that I am today. But for the longest, the game was who I was. It was my identity. I didn't know who Derek Morgan was outside of this game. I tried to shake this reality in a business that tells you your value is your performance, end quote. See, that to me is really interesting. What was the experience like of having the game be your identity? And then once the game is gone, what do you do if it was your identity?
Man, it's a continued journey, you know, and from age 9, I've been playing football, and I've had all of my influences telling me that football was my vehicle, my way out. And so you kind of, as a young kid, you put all your eggs in one basket, and you see this as your way out to change you and your family's circumstances. So you go all in. And for those of us, the few of us that are lucky enough to reach our childhood dream, you know, we kind of still carry that mindset and that philosophy going into the league. And so when I got to the league, I was like, okay, cool. I made it to the promised land. This is it. This is who I am. This is what I do. And then, boom, I tear my ACL week 4 of my rookie year. So my whole reality was shaken by that, and that really woke me up. You know, I was kind of alert and lulled asleep by the NFL and everything that it offered. And so I was completely bought into that narrative of, you know, I'm the NFL player, this is who I am. And so when I had to come off that injury my rookie year, it sort of forced me to put things into perspective, to ask hard questions like, hey, look, if that was your last game, now what? What do you do? And so I never really thought about that. I was so one-track minded in terms of reaching my goals that I wasn't really evolving myself outside of the game. And so having that injury my rookie year forced me to wake up and start sprinkling seeds in different areas that weren't football. So I really started to leverage my platform, develop relationships, and increase my network through my career, and understanding that, look, you're an NFL player. People are 9 times out of 10 going to take a meeting with you. And so once you hang up those cleats, that might not be the reality. So take advantage of it while you're in. And every person, every guy that I talked to, you know, that had played the game and was retired, they kept saying, Derek, do it now. Do everything while you're in the league. And, you know, and I took that to heart.
God, that's such great advice. Do everything while you're in the league. And, Derek, unfortunately, we started the conversation late, so we're almost out of time. But before you go, I want to ask you about something else. You and I have talked about a plant-based diet in the past. You're part of an upcoming documentary, The Game Changers, and a good friend of mine, James Lightning Wilkes, is right in the middle of that. For those who are not on that train, lay it out for them. What do you like about the plant-powered life?
I think that you hit on the head. It's lifestyle. You know, it's something that I went on the journey about 2 years ago, looking for a competitive edge in my recovery and my my training. And, you know, I felt the effects probably within 3 weeks. You know, my blood pressure was down. My inflammation markers in my blood were down, which allowed me to recover faster. And, you know, my energy was good. And so, it's, you know, my wife is a chef, you know, Chef Charity Morgan on Instagram, if you want to give her a follow. But she has really been influential in helping me change over to this lifestyle. And, you know, it's been beneficial in many different ways.
We were talking to Derek Morgan. Now, Derek, you've also been working to defund private prisons. All right. That's something else different. How'd you first get involved with that?
Watched this documentary called The 13th on Netflix. And it dove into the private prison industry, how those were public companies, and that you could be unknowingly invested in these companies on the stock market. And so another wake-up call for me was finding out what my money was doing. And so from that process, I started to really educate myself on what my money was doing in the market, started to reallocate it to more impactful investments, things that were more tangible, affordable housing, technology training for minorities, things that I could really see the positive impact. And I really started to transition my money to those types of investments, but just being very intentional with how my money is working for me.
Derek Morgan, my guest. Derek, you announced your retirement on Monday. You and I need more time. We always need more time than that. I'm literally out of time for the entire program. What do you say we get caught up again soon and finish the other part of this interview? But in the meantime, it was good to have you back on. Congratulations on the announcement, and you and I can cover some more ground next time we talk.
Yeah, man, I appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
Great talking to you, Derek. I appreciate it. We had a lot more to talk about. We really did. But ran out of time.
Just having to understand another game. And I guess, you know, I played in so many different schemes. You know, because I played for, let's see, since I've been in the NFL, this is my fourth head coach. And then in college, you know, I played in a pretty complicated defensive scheme. So I've learned a lot about defenses. So I kind of have a good understanding of different schemes and how to play within different schemes and how to play different positions. So the transition, it really hasn't been too hard for me.
Yeah, Mark, are you one of those guys then, because you see this sometimes, some guys can just pick stuff up really quickly,
right.
Really, really quickly. Are you one of those guys, or are you just somebody who's on that grind, who prepares, and who's always willing to work and do what it takes to learn it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to do whatever I need to do to be successful, regardless of how much it takes, how much work it takes. Whatever I got to do to go out and be successful and perform at the level at the standard I hold myself to, that's what I'll do.
You know, when Sean McVay was hired, people in the coaching community raved about how special and how unique, how different this young guy was. From a player's perspective, what's it been like to play for him?
It's been great. Obviously, like I said, he's leading us to my first winning season. And just sitting back and watching him work, you know, I see so much in him that I've seen. I'll just be specific when I say this about I see a lot of things that I saw with Coach Saban and him when it comes to precision and attention to details and you know, just staying on top of everything. And for him to be that young and doing it, it's really something special to see.
You know, what about that attention to detail? How big of an impact does that have? And then how does that show up in winning or losing a game? People always talk about attention to detail.
People always talk about it, but people don't always follow through with it. Or people don't always have that attention to detail. They always talk about it, but they don't necessarily have it. And when you have it, you're able to have some of the success that we're having, like right now. And, you know, in this league, everything comes down to sometimes it comes down to just those small details. Like, you know, the margin of victory is not usually that big. I mean, we have some blowouts this year, but usually, you know, margin of victory is not much. So a lot of times it comes down to, you know, something small. Just even like this battle we got coming up, you know, it's two good teams. So a lot of times games like that come down to who make the least mistakes and who's going to have the most attention to detail.
So before you bounce, how about one thought on that battle? You've got Philadelphia, Carson Wentz. A win on Sunday would give you a tiebreaker over two of the three teams that are battling for that first round bye. How do you go about preparing to stop that offense and that quarterback?
We go about it the same way we go about every game. I mean, we don't take anybody lightly. We do understand it's a big game, but we're gonna trust, you know, our process. We're gonna trust what we're doing. We've been successful for it, so. We'll just keep preparing the way we have, and we'll go out and play our game the way we've been doing.
That does it.